Okay, time for another one.
Oh, man. Okay, so we just covered a whole bunch of stuff on DNA. Yesterday, we covered a whole bunch of stuff on proteins, and we saw that both types of molecules have three-dimensional structures that are presumably biologically or biochemically relevant. As with most things, when scientists determine information about a molecule structure, they want to be able to post it somewhere to make it easier for other scientists to access. And so you can imagine that some of the early crystallography experiments, the early protein structure experiments on things like hemoglobin, were not only important from the perspective of oxygen transport, but they taught us about things like what residues like to form alpha helices versus what residues don't like to form alpha helices. And so there's all sorts of information in a protein structure that may not be directly relevant to the enzymology of that particular protein, but may be important. And a scientist might not know that their protein is going to be important for some other structural reason as well. And so having these things in one place, not only does it combine things so that everybody interested in working on G-protein coupled receptors or chymodulin or GB3, that they can all look at the structural variants, but it also allows people to create large databases and try to understand physical or statistical properties of protein structures. And so you might ask yourself a question, how many different types of protein folds are there? Right? So we're not talking about protein sequences now. We're talking about, how many different ways are there to mix and match alpha helices and beta strands so that the whole thing comes together and forms one nice globular structure. That's a question that you probably can't answer or even think about until you've seen or have the ability to see a whole bunch of protein structures together to sort of see what the guiding physical principles are. Similarly, if you ever hope to be able to predict a protein's folded structure just given the primary sequence, sure, one way to approach that problem would be, okay, well, here's all the physical forces. Let's put those all together in a box and see what comes out. Clearly, that's how nature does it. But it turns out that those types of algorithms are very slow and not terribly accurate. And so it's often better to say, well, have I seen this sequence before? And if I've seen it before, what structure does it adopt in other folded proteins? And from a point of view of statistics, actually it turns out that that works quite well. And so that's one of the bases for how modern structure prediction programs work, is they look at a large library of protein structure and try to figure out how these things work. And what on average does a particular sequence like to sample? And so we very briefly, we probably mostly just mentioned it yesterday, the PDB, the Protein Data Bank. And the Protein Data Bank is the location where scientists store structural information. Started out with PDB or protein files, but now it's all types of structures, RNA and even carbohydrate and lipid, any kind of biological structure that you can get your hands on will end up in the PDB. Small molecules end up typically in the Cambridge Structure Database. But if you're thinking about big proteins, then that's what we're working on. Now, this number, I think, is out of date. I updated it elsewhere, but I don't think I updated it here. But when you think about what is in the PDB, you sort of have to think about how it got there, too. And there's two primary means by which one can take a protein or a DNA molecule and determine the three-dimensional orientation of the individual atoms in space. X-ray crystallography or X-ray diffraction is probably the most popular way to do it. It's typically more precise, and even as an NMR spectroscopist, I would prefer to work with an X-ray structure than an NMR structure. You know, we're not going to talk about theoretically how these things are calculated. Feel free to come and take my grad class if you want to do that. But generally speaking, this is, you know, you have to crystallize your protein, you shoot it in front of an X-ray, and then you back calculate from the reflections that you observe what the position of atoms in space are that give rise to those reflections. NMR is the alternative method. And you know, just like you know, in your organic chemistry class, it's not an obvious way to calculate the structure of a molecule looking at the NMR spectra. Often you need things like constraints or restraints. And these are things that say that this particular proton is close in space to this other particular proton. I think I'll leave it at that. So you can imagine if you have enough distance restraints, you could determine, just like if I told you that the distance between Los Angeles and New York is something like, 5,000 miles? Maybe less than that, 4,000? Who knows? I've never done the drive, so I'm thankfully. But if I give you enough distances between major cities in the U.S., you could eventually figure out that there's one set of orientations that, you might not end up with New York and the New Northeast, but if you look at the orientation between New York and LA, you would eventually figure out that, this is farther north, than LA, and LA is a little bit farther north than San Antonio, and everything is farther north than Miami. And so you could work out the distances and the positions of cities if I gave you enough distances. This is the same thing for NMR. Computers are obviously tremendously helpful here. Most PDB files are solved using X-ray crystallography. At the time that I made this slide, there were about 120,000 structures total, and over 107,000 of them are crystal structures. So the vast majority are X-ray. Sometimes you find the oddball structure that's come up from some kind of modeling or a computer simulation. But generally the PDB contains structures from experimental data. So it's being built up that more and more you'll see some things in like from cryo-electron microscopy too. But mostly it's X-ray and NMR. And so typically in X-ray structure, you're looking at something called the electron density. Again, this electron density is calculated from the reflections that you observe. And what you're ultimately doing is fitting atoms into electron density. And so in this case, this is looking at DNA. So you're looking at guanine. And you can see that the electron density sort of fits around the guanine base. And ultimately you sort of see these blobs of electron density, and you try to fit your atoms so that they make sense into the density that you've calculated. Oftentimes you don't see hydrogens, and so even though there are hydrogens sticking off of these rings in many of the positions, hydrogen atoms are small, and so they don't diffract X-rays very easily. And so most of the structures that you look at in the PDB will have heavy atoms, but if they're determined crystallographically, they generally don't have hydrogens. Now there are exceptions. If you have very high resolution, so resolution down less than an angstrom, you can often resolve hydrogen atoms. But keep in mind, these are small, so not only are they small to begin with, but they don't scatter X-rays very well. And so, so you generally don't see them. And then obviously, like I said, molecular mechanics are used to help in this refinement. Usually the experimentalist goes in and makes a first pass, this is where I think the chain is going to go, and then he plugs in molecular mechanics, and then they sort of optimize the agreement between the protein position and the electron density, try to fit everything in. Because of that, this is an experimental technique, right? So you can't just look at something in the protein data bank and assume that you know, it's the word of God truth about a particular protein structure. I mean, not only are these things subject to, you know, experimental limitations, and so, for example, perhaps the only way that the researchers can get the protein to crystallize is by putting it into some very, very high concentration of glycerol. And so, by and large, glycerol doesn't change protein structures, but it can stabilize protein structures. Similarly, a lot of these crystal structures are solved under some kind of cryoprotectant. So they stream liquid nitrogen or very cold nitrogen gas over the crystal, so that while they're firing X-rays at it, it doesn't sort of melt and deteriorate. So the temperature that you're looking at is nowhere near physiological in most cases. And so there's experimental limitations. You know, there's also the fact that people make mistakes. There have been times when, you know, during this process, people have actually reversed the chain and fed it into the wrong direction and basically got a total garbage structure out of the crystallography. And those articles are usually retracted, but experimentalists can make mistakes on these things. And so there's several metrics available on the PBD, and we'll look at where these are, that sort of give you an idea for, you know, is this X-ray crystal structure good quality structure or not? You know, this is really important if you're doing simulation, because you want to start with a structure that you think is actually representative, not just, you know, this is what some experimentalists, you know, came up with and they're trying to publish before they got scooped. And again, all these, there's theoretical background for all these. Basically, I'm just giving you a laundry list so that you can sort of go through and make some quick assessments about whether a structure is reliable. If a structure doesn't match these criteria, it doesn't mean that it's garbage. You know, I have on here the resolution of the structure should be less than 2.5 angstroms. But if you go back to the original crystal structure of the ribosome, I believe done by Ada Yonath, the resolution of that was 3.5 angstroms, and they got her the Nobel Prize. So keep in mind what you're looking for. If you're just looking for gross structural features, you might not need resolution below 1.5 angstroms. And in that case, you know, the ribosome was such a major discovery at the time that, you know, it didn't matter that the resolution wasn't great. It still told you a heck of a lot about how this mechanism was working. So the R factor, often called the refinement factor, is sort of an estimate of, you can think of it like a correlation coefficient, so or a percent error. So what's the percent error of the atoms that I've calculated relative to the data that I've collected. And so generally you want that to be as low as possible. For organic structures, it's not uncommon to see an R factor of 4% or lower. And in fact, they would look at a protein and say, well, that's ridiculous error. But on the other hand, there's a lot more atoms in a protein than an organic molecule. So you want this generally to be less than 25%, and if you can, less than 20%. The problem is that as with all things, over time, standards change. And initially, you know, people thought, well, 25%, that's great. And that was sufficient to get into the PEB. There's even some 30% structures in there. But nowadays, with the technology that we have, you know, modern structures really should be pushing this 20% of that. Similarly, old structures don't have a free R, or R-free value. And the R-free is essentially the same thing as an R-factor, except what you've done is you've left out some of your original data. So that data basically goes in a box. It's like Al Gore. You put Social Security in a box, black box. Lockbox, I guess. So that data goes into a lockbox. You do your refinements, and you calculate what the structure should be, and then you come back at the end of the day, and you compare your refined structure to the data that you left out. And so that's sort of the percent error relative to the data that you left out. It's always going to be bigger than just the overall percent error because you weren't able to refine against it. But it still shouldn't be, you know, it shouldn't be huge. Obviously, the higher the resolution, the more distinction you can make between atoms. So if I have a 1-angstrom structure, that means I can tell if two atoms are 1-angstrom apart. If I have a 2.5-angstrom structure, that means I can't tell if they're 1-angstrom apart, but I can tell if they're 2-angstrom apart. So lower resolution is better, lower numerical resolution. But usually, I mean, you don't have to go crazy on this. If you're thinking about drug interaction with a protein or drug interacting with DNA, 1.5 angstroms is actually great for that kind of measurement. Below 1 angstroms, you can start seeing hydrogens, and so you'll start to see if you look at some of the very very low high resolution structures in the PDB, you will see hydrogens. And those are actually experimentally determined. We'll talk about some clash scores and violation or validation metrics that are done. And then finally, if you think about a protein being a 10 kilodalton protein, oftentimes in a crystal structure, you'll open up and there'll be some water molecules. Often those water molecules are associated with the protein, so they're making hydrogen bonds to different side chains. Often the first thing I do is just get rid of them. But if you look at them and there's an inordinate number of water molecules in your structure, that might mean that the experimentalist who submitted that structure is using water molecules to sort of sop up electron density that might otherwise not be accounted for in the protein structure itself. And so if there's a lot of extra electron density that they can't fit protein into, they might put some extra water molecules in there to increase or improve the agreement between the experimental data and the structure that they submit. So 2 to 5 water molecules per kilodalton is a pretty good rule of thumb. That's what I've been using for the past 7-8 years. And so it seems like that's about average. So we can go look at the PDB. I think this is the same slide as before. And so we're going to go and look at this structure, 3TJW. We'll see that the format has changed a little bit. So these images don't necessarily appear on the PDB, but these are quite nice. I mean, this one will. This one I don't think does anymore. But this is quite nice to fit into a slide. So that's why I left it here. But let's go to the PDB and let's look at 3TJW. Yeah. And so when you go to the PDB, I mean, it's actually quite a nice website. There's lots of updates. I don't really subscribe to any of the news features on the PDB. But they usually try to have like a molecule of the month, which can be fun if you're like teaching undergrads or something like that, to say, hey, look, the molecule of the month is, this molecule. There's also some, information about news, changes to things, like if they're adding new structures, that'll appear. It's nice, it's fluffy, but the main reason that you go to the PDB is to look up a structure. And so we're going to go in, and again, remember that PDB accession codes or ID numbers are always going to be 4 letters. Maybe eventually we'll get to a point where that's no longer true. Actually, that's before we do that. So now you can see that the total number of structures is 130,000. I think that slide was probably from like 2 years ago. On average, they add about 20,000 structures a year. And so if you're at MSU, you're welcome. I keep a up-to-date copy of the PDB on my lab server. That's probably not helpful to the folks at Huntsville, but it does mean that if you ever have to do any large-scale mining, you're welcome to log into my server and do it that way. Or I can give you the scripts to download it so you have your own copy. Okay, so you're looking at 3TJW. And so when you open up an accession page, again, they give you a very brief picture. We'll talk in this session about how you can make pictures like this. This is the crystal structure of the villain headpiece, so the chicken villain headpiece, which is probably one of the smallest proteins out there that still folds. And so I think it's only like 30 residues. We can probably look that up. So here you can see what the length is. 34 residues. It's forming a three-helix bundle. I believe there's a tryptophan in the middle of here that sort of forms a hydrophobic core, if one residue can be a core. And the protein folds around that. And so one of the things that you can look here, so already we talked about, so what's the resolution when we can read that right off here? It's 1.46 angstroms. The R free value is 0.19, so 19%. And the R value, the working R value, is 15%. So quite a good structure using those refinement metrics that we talked about. Similarly, if you look here, it gives you some ideas of how this structure ranks to ranks compared to other structures of the similar resolution, right? So in this case, you can collect all the structures between, 1.4 and 1.5 angstroms, and you can look to see, how does their R-free look? And in this case, this is a very high percentile structure. Let's see if I can make this a little bigger. Right, so this is in the upper percentile. This means if it's white, it's about average. And then this guy, now there is a way to download the full report and see what the numbers are. But again, you guys probably aren't gonna care that much, right? You wanna know, quickly, is this structure good, is it bad? What's not to love? And so you can see there's the R-free value is actually pretty good compared to all structures. And then it's so-so compared to structures of similar resolution, right? So if you work at this high resolution, you would expect to have very good agreement with your data. And so just because it's so-so doesn't mean that it's bad. I would worry if it were way over here. But anything over to the right-hand side of this plot means that it's usually good. Clash score. This is sort of an assessment of, is there steric clash? Right, and so generally you don't find situations where two atoms are perfectly superimposed. There is one structure in the PDB where that happens, where two atoms have the exact same XYZ coordinates, and it would always cause my programs to break when I was a graduate student, because it would they would calculate and be like, the energy is crazy. But I think that's the only one, and since then they've had checks. But this is like if there's a little bit of overlap between two atoms nearby. And so, you want your clash score to be good. That means that there's not a lot of clashes. But anything that's tightly packed is going to have some overlap. And so it's impossible to get like zero clashes. And so this guy's doing okay. It's not great as far as clash score, but it's still nothing to snort at. Ramachandran outliers. Remember we talked about using the Ramachandran plot as a way to assess whether protein structures are good. So this has zero Ramachandran outliers. So every single phi psi residue or phi psi value for this protein falls within the allowed region of the Ramachandran plot. And then this is side chain real space or residue specific outliers. Again, it's looking at the sort of the percent error of a specific residue. If you can imagine that. And again, you want that to be low. It's not exactly a percent error, but it's still pretty good. And so you can go into the full report and read up. I mean, this is a PDF file, and you can read up on all of the structure validation statistics that they use. Percentiles here, quality. If you're curious about the Ramachandran outliers, I believe it will eventually give you a Ramachandran plot. I hope. Probably more information than you ever care to know. I guess not. It probably just reports the actual values. Okay. You can go down, you can continue to scroll down, you can see that there are related structures. You can link to the original publication on PubMed, which is the NCBI journal database. Scrolling down more, you can see there's information about the protein features or the genes. And so if there are multiple domains, and this is just a single domain protein, so there's not a whole lot to look at here. But you can see that there's a, this is the headpiece of the villain protein. And so you can use information here, WY3, so this is sort of telling you about homology. We'll talk about some bioinformatics stuff tomorrow, so don't worry about that too much. But this is sort of giving you the overall structure of the gene. And since oftentimes domains are solved separately, this sort of gives you the context of what the protein is being, the protein that you're looking at. Oftentimes additional solvent atoms will appear. And again, so you can imagine you're crystallizing a molecule. In this case, there's some sulfate that crystallized with the protein. And there's some additional residues here. So they were looking at, I don't know what all these are, but DLE, DSN, so these look like maybe they're deuterated. Potentially that gives them information on, they're dipeptides. Look at that. That's cool. Learn something new every day. I didn't realize this was a D. And then if you look further, you can get information. And then up here at the top, there's all sorts of stuff too. You can look at the sequence, for example. So if I click on the sequence and I scroll down, not only does it give me the sequence, but it sort of shows me what the secondary structure is associated with the sequence. I can change this if I just want to download the sequence itself. I can download it here. I sort of wish there was a way to look at Ramachandran plots, and I feel like there is, but maybe I'm missing it. But anyway, you don't have to worry about it. If you care not to use PyMOL, you can use their sort of poor man's JavaScript viewer, which sometimes is enough. Can give you some more information about the orientation of those helices. But usually I recommend PyMOL, which is what we're going to spend more of our time on. For comparison, not every structure is this good. So if we look at another structure, so this is 1SNC. This is staphylococcal nuclease. And again, we don't have everything here. And rather than try to go to the website, I'll just sort of summarize what you can see. But this is a structure that's much older. It was solved in, the 90s. And so, some of the things are actually missing. Like, for example, that was before our free values were commonly calculated. And so it doesn't have one. And so just because that says NA, again, doesn't mean that it's a bad structure. It just means that, it was submitted at a time when that protein wasn't required. They're not going to go back to the investigator who submitted it and say, hey, you got to recalculate this. Because again, calculating R-free would mean making that lockbox, leaving some data out, and basically re-refining the structure. So they don't make people do that, thankfully. But you can look at the R-value, that they can calculate, even if the investigator never did. And it's not a bad value. And the resolution's not bad either. But if you start looking, digging a little bit deeper into sidechain outliers, real space refinement outliers, it's not performing necessarily as well as some of the other structures in its class. If I were looking at this, again, it's probably a perfectly reasonable representation of this protein, but I might go in and I might see if there's other structures that score a little bit better on these side chains and maybe the steric clash, outliers. Or I'll go into that full report and look and read specifically about what the problems are with that particular chain. Okay, so what is a PDB file? So if we go here, and we go to 3TJW, actually I'm not gonna go to that one quite yet. We'll go to that one maybe in a bit. Let's go to 1SNC. So if I go here to download file, and I download the PDB format, I can save it. And so for the first part of this presentation, I think we're going to use this computer, and then I'll switch to my laptop. But I can save it to the desktop. You know, you guys can look at it too. Likely it's not going to be associated with anything, so it's just going to show up as a generic file. Yeah, so if I double click on it, it's not going to do anything. And since I don't have administrator access, it's going to give me some pretty limited options. Generally, if you're looking at a PDB file, you want to open it up in WordPad. Even though it's a text file, WordPad, it actually uses Unix carriage returns. And so if you open up in Notepad, it's going to give you all sorts of weird, you know, it's basically going to put it all in one line, which is probably not what you want. Okay, so if I open up the PDB file, you can see it's just a whole bunch of text. It's all in capital letters. I might need to make it a little bit smaller because sometimes the lines overlap. Let's see if that's the case here. Yeah, so you can see it's wrapping around, you know, this 1.0 back to this line. So let's make this a little bit... you know, I can either go in and maybe try to change my page size, or the easiest thing to do is just make the font smaller. There we go. And let's see if I can zoom in so we can... Okay, so now everything's on one line, as it should be. Okay, so I start out here at the top of the PDB file, and you can see that a lot of the same information is up here in the PDB file itself. Come on, just give me the top. Oh, there we go. Now you can make it easy to read. Okay. So this is a nuclease, this is involved, this is a protein that Staphylococcus expresses as a means of chewing up other DNAs that are not, I believe, not methylated as a means of sort of protecting its own genome from contamination or from plasmid that it doesn't like. And so it's, you know, cuts up DNAs. You can see at the top, I mean, it gives us a header. You know, what are we looking at here? The title of the thing, which hopefully has something of the protein name in. So this is the crystal structure of the ternary complex of staph nuclease, calcium, and the inhibitor PD star TP, refined at 1.65 angstroms. That's going to be similar if I look here. I mean, that's the title here, too. So, you know, a lot of the information on this page is recapitulated in the file itself. Now, clearly the graphics are not recapitulated. Some of that's calculated using information here. But in principle, the way this file is set up is that nothing on that first page in the PDB website, you know, should be new. All the information should be stored here somehow. And you might need a special program to convert it into a nice graphical format, but you should be able to get access to the information here. And so, for example, there's a whole bunch of remarks. And oftentimes, this information is actually even more in-depth than what's on the website. So here's a lot of information about how this thing was refined. And so you can get information about the R value, how the free R was determined, if it exists. In this case, it wasn't determined. And then there's information about the experimental acquisition. So if this was recorded at a synchrotron X-ray source, that information will be in here. Why is that important to know? Well, if for example, it's like going into your grocery store and saying that there was a recall on Sargento cheese, right? Maybe there was a time when the synchrotron wasn't operating as it should have been, and you know, maybe it was giving, you know, the wavelength was slightly off, or maybe there was some other problem with the synchrotron. Knowing that and having that information here makes it easy to go back and trace to see. It's like keeping a good lab notebook entry. You sort of keep an eye on the history of how the structure was determined. But you know, usually there's several pages of this remark information before you start getting information on the actual structure. So when you end with the remarks, you know, now you're talking about, you know, here's the sequence of the protein. So these are represented by these secres. And if you look here, every single line starts with six characters or so that tell you something about what's on that line. Okay, so secres is telling you about the residue sequence of the protein or in the PDB file. There's some information about where the helix parts of the chain are. There's information about where the sheets are. Again, I'm not going to cover how all these are parsed, but you can go and look up that information on your own. You know, if there's information about, you know, sort of non-natural or somewhat unique chemical bonding, because there's a unique inhibitor here, there's information about how that works in the either the hydrogen bonding or you know, chemical bonding that might not necessarily be there. That's here. Any kind of rotation or symmetry axes are stored in here. So that's where the org X are. And then finally, you get to these atom records, which are storing the three-dimensional structure of the atoms, right? And so now in this case, I will break it down because it is useful to know how this information is stored, right? So the first six characters is always reserved for sort of the description of that line. In this case, it's only four characters. But then we have sort of an atom index number in the second column. And you can see that just increments, you know, by one for each new atom that appears in the PDB. Then what we have is the atom name. Okay, and so remember we talked in the protein section yesterday that there was like an alpha carbon, that there was an amino nitrogen, that there was an oxygen associated with the backbone. And as you went down into the side chain, you had beta carbons, delta carbons, etc., gamma carbons. You obviously can't put, well, in this case, you can't put a Greek character into a traditional text file. And so the way the PDB does that is they use CA to represent C alpha or alpha carbons, you know, C beta, gamma, delta, epsilon. All of these are represented as specific atom names. And so the next column stores the name or the designation of that atom using IUPAC type of conventions. And then the residue name, so this is the three-letter code, LEU. A chain identifier, so if there are multiple separate chains, remember quaternary structure, stored in the PDB file. You know, those are usually named as far as chain A, chain B, C, D, etc. This one, I believe, only has one chain. It's chain A. Sometimes there won't be a column if they just leave this blank. But most of the time, you'll see something in this entry here. And then there's the residue number. So you'll notice that the first seven residues aren't, or the first six residues don't appear in the PDB file. And so it starts with residue 7 because that's the first one that they could detect. And things that are relatively floppy and aren't static don't have a well-defined electron density. And so you're not generally going to see the structures, the atomic positions of things that are fairly flexible. Or alternatively, if every single structure is rigid, but every protein has a slightly different conformation, that's also going to cause that electron density to be blurred and is going to inhibit the value that you can see here. So you're not going to see those types of residues either. Finally, here we get to X, Y, Z coordinates. So these three columns are the coordinates in angstroms. And you know, they're in order of X, Y, and Z. And then we have two final columns. One is called the occupancy, and one is called the B factor. The occupancy is reserved for those special cases where sometimes if you do have static disorder, maybe you see an aspartic acid or an asparagine, you know, occasionally it branches off over here and makes a hydrogen bond with this residue, and then occasionally it branches off over here and makes a hydrogen bond with this residue, and you can actually see a mixture of those two in the crystal structure. Again, the crystal is the average over the entire crystal, so if there's multiple conformations, you can see them if they appear statically. And that occupancy can be used to give you, okay, 50% of the structure is in this conformation, 50% of the structure is in this conformation. And so that's what it's telling you when it says occupancy. And then the temperature factor is a measure sort of static disorder in the structure itself. And this was originally hypothesized to say that there's thermal motions in the crystal structure. And if the temperature factor is big, that means there's lots of thermal motions. If it's small, that means that the thermal motion is fairly constrained. And you can imagine that an atom will have a radius, and the electron density will also have a radius. And if there's a big discrepancy between an atom's radius and the electron density radius, again, they're modeling that as thermal motion that's causing that radius to be a little bit bigger. Turns out that that's a terrible approximation, but it's still frequently used. And if you're curious about it, I can show you papers where they've basically tested. You know, they you can always go in and generate a B factor from a series of structures. And so they made some very ridiculous structures and saw that you could see some very reasonable B factors. And so you always sort of have to use a grain of salt when you're interpreting this B factor column. But roughly speaking, you can sort of say, okay, higher B factors correspond to somewhat more dynamic positions in the chain. And then the last column is just, you know, this is sort of an optional column. It doesn't appear in every file, but it's the elements code for that particular residue. You can always, you know, if you have the lookup table, you can always figure out that this is going to be oxygen and this is going to be carbon. But having it here as an explicit column makes it a little easier for some of the data mining that you might want to do. If I continue to scroll down, Scroll. Keep scrolling. I think I'm going to jump down. So there's 146 residues in staphanase, 141, so there you go. So eventually, you get to this terminator record. And then there's a whole bunch of what are called heteroatom records. And these correspond to, in this case, this is the calcium atom, or the calcium ion that appears in the structure. And then the rest of this is the inhibitor. That they talk about. So that's called THP, and you can see what the atoms of the THP molecule are. And then if you keep going down, eventually you start getting to these HOH entries. And as you might imagine, those are the oxygen atoms of water molecules. And so, again, all the information, all the three-dimensional coordinates are stored here. The format, even though these start with heteroatom or head atom, is still the same. And so this would still be your X, Y, Z coordinates. You would still have an occupancy. You can see there's some numbers down here that are lower than one, meaning that they might be sort of transient waters, But they also have a B factor associated with them as well. So all this information is great, but it turns out that it's really, I mean, you know, it's nice that I can look at the three-dimensional coordinates in space, but really what I want to see is what do they look like in space? And so for that, you need programs to visualize what the structure looks like. And so for that, we're going to use a program called PyMOL. I'm going to quickly go through these slides, and then we'll throw up my laptop here, and we'll actually open up and sort of take you through using PyMOL. But you'll see that there's a lab listed for tonight. And again, it's optional doing, but hopefully it's useful. This is a beginner's guide to using PyMOL. If you work through this, you will understand a lot of sort of the nuts and bolts of how to do some of this visualization and making pretty molecular graphics yourself. So we'll cover some of the high points, but just like with Nuplot, I'll leave it to you to go through the actual lab. You'll learn a lot more that way better, or you'll learn a lot more that way anyway. Okay, so PyMOL is a great program. It was written by a guy named Warren Delano. I had the privilege of meeting him several times. Unfortunately, he passed away, almost 10, more than 10 years ago now. And when he died, his wife basically took the PyMOL property, if you will, and gave it to a company called Schrodinger. I'm not a huge fan of what Schrodinger's been doing with the software. I'm perfectly honest on that. But it's still what I think is the best software around. And because Warren wrote it as open source, to a certain extent, there's constraints on how much Schrodinger can screw up the software. Certainly, as they add new features, they are under no obligation to make those features open source. And so there's differences between the pure Schrodinger version and the pure open source version. But the nice thing is that Schrodinger does maintain an educational version that we can use in a context like this. And the core source code that Warren released as open source is and always will be available. And so if your Unix and Linux chops are good enough, you'll always be able to compile your own version, even if Schrodinger continues to not add new features. So, that said, Schrodinger is the gatekeeper if you want to download the simplest version. That is the Windows executable or the Mac executable. The most recent educational releases have been kind of hit or miss. They work, but as part of Schrodinger's jerkery, they've disabled critical features, well, I would consider critical features like ray tracing, just because, well, they figure most educational users don't know how to compile their own software, and so that keeps them from using that version indefinitely. Other than that, it's not really crippled, but there have been occasional places where the bug has cropped up. Like if you try to calculate a distance, I think in one of them it crashed. The older educational builds can still be found, and so you basically go to that website, you give them your email address, you make a lot of signatures saying that I'm not going to use this outside of an educational context. And for them, educational is different from research. So even if you're at a university doing research, they still want you to buy it. So I recommend 1.3 revision 1, which is almost 10 years old at this point. And so it is feeling its age a little bit. But the newer versions aren't that bad. And again, what we'll show you is that there are ways to get it so that you don't have to go through the gatekeepers here and get something that's actually quite powerful and not crippled by Schrodinger's arbitrary decisions. One of these days, I'm hoping Schrodinger downloads this lecture and starts, they'll probably send a lawyer here. But anyway, obtaining PyMOL, again, I've done some of this for you. So I've gone to the website and I've signed away my firstborn child and said that I will only distribute this in an academic sense. And so you can go to the PyMOL website, the username and password are there, and that'll let you download a copy for your computer. And for the purposes of this class, that's probably the easiest way to do it. I've also included some old versions using Google links. Those are even though you can't see it, those are hosted on the Bootcamp website. And so if you click those, it should give you a link to the older educational version as well. And again, probably the easiest way to obtain PyMOL for this class. But technically speaking, you're supposed to delete it when you're done with the bootcamp.
Now, like I said, PyMOL is open source. And so we're not going to cover all of this, but if you have access to a Linux distribution, or maybe you have a friend with a really powerful copy of Windows Development Studio or whatever they're calling it nowadays. You can compile it yourself. And the nice thing about the versions that you compile yourself is that they're not crippled by Schrodinger. So ray tracing works. People will fix bugs if they find them. This is what we do in our lab. That's why all of my students have access to their own Linux terminal, because I want them to be able to do this themselves. And on Ubuntu, it's trivial. You basically type, I probably need to have sudo there, but you have to be administrator, and you basically type apt-get install PyMOL, and it installs it for you. And then when you type PyMOL, it brings up PyMOL. It's like magic.
If you're using a Red Hat or a CentOS-based version, again, we're not going to cover this at all, but I wanted this to be in your slide so that if you are in a situation where you can use it, now you don't have to find it on the web or figure it out yourself. So on CentOS, basically you have to do a whole bunch of stuff. You basically have to compile it yourself. And so this is the instructions for compiling it. You have to get all these extra libraries that aren't normally included in CentOS.
And then the next slide, you have to download the source code from the PyMOL source website. You extract it using the same command that Yua taught you yesterday for tar. And that will basically put all the source code on your directory. And then you have to compile PyMOL. And so you do that by going to that source code directory. You type python setup.py build, and then sudo python setup.py install. Those two will take probably about 2 to 3 minutes, depending on the speed of your computer. And it'll spew out a lot of text to the screen. Hopefully everything works. But then once that works, then you can run your own version of PyMOL, and it's not going to have any of the Schrodinger stuff installed. So that's there for your personal edification. And again, if you're working in a lab where they have Linux systems sitting around, or you have your own Linux system, and you have administrative access, you can maybe do this yourself or show this to your administrator, and they can probably figure it out from there. You can also install your own virtual computer, run Linux that way, and use PyMOL in that context as well. But that, I think, is even beyond what the level of this class will be. There are alternatives to PyMOL. So UCF Chimera is probably the one I would recommend if you're really not going to use PyMOL. It's a little bit steeper learning curve. So I'm tending to lean towards keeping PyMOL for now. But if Schrodinger continues to disable things and produce buggy software for educational use, this would probably be the option that I would use. But really, I would really like to, not only is PyMOL a great program, I think Warren's philosophy of making PyMOL was just fabulous. VMD is another option, but frankly, I just don't think the images are as good. You guys in the molecular simulations might disagree, but MoleScript is ancient. I think that's been around since the 90s, maybe even older. And it's hard to use, but I guess if it's ancient, that means I'm ancient. That's kind of sad. Anyway, it's been around for a long time. But it's pretty tricky to use. But I think, even today, I think
with all the stuff that's available, I think the images that Molescript are still some of the best out there. And you can find a history of molecular visualization. It's actually kind of cool. A lot of these things, I mean, just like video games have sort of driven the more recent advances in graphics cards and computer technology, a lot of the molecular visualization has driven some of the advances that, you know, really predated that. And so, you know, if you think about, and I know that they're not so popular anymore, but those 3D televisions, the technology that is used for 3D televisions is actually, I mean, it's actually like 30 years old. Well, maybe not quite 30. But certainly it was developed, I think, in 91, 92. 91. So, you know, some of the early computer workstations to do that were designed with the intent of looking at molecular visualization. We have a Silicon Graphics system downstairs that is equally ancient. It's actually Edwin's, and if he ever wants to take it up and put it in his lab, we would love him to take it out of the NMR facility. But I actually have some of the old, they're huge. I mean, you still have to use the glasses, but they're huge, but they get the job done. Okay, so let's sort of take a look at what you can do with PyMol. I was hoping to use this session to catch up a little bit, and it looks like we're not doing that. but it's not going to take me an hour and 20 minutes to do keeping a lab notebook either. So let's briefly go through, and we can take a quick look at what PyMol looks like. Yeah, I thought I reduced the lab notebook session to an hour, but maybe not. So again, you really want to go through this tonight. I do think it does a pretty good job of introducing you to the major features of PyMol. And like I said, even with all the stuff that I don't like from Schrodinger, it's still, I think, hands down the best program out there. And let's see, let's download the 1SNC file. Oftentimes, if you're lucky, you can just type the PDB code in Google and it'll bring it up. And if you're not lucky, you're not connected to the internet. Okay, now we are. Okay. So I'm going to download the PDB file just like I did before. And in this case, I automatically launched PyMol. You can also save it on your desktop and launch PyMol by double-clicking. Once you install PyMol, it will associate with PDB files. And so then you don't have to keep double-clicking on the PDB files over and over again. It does open up with two windows, which, you know, some people love, some people hate. On a Mac, I believe it just uses the one window. And here again, you can see that when we open it up, we get this nice view of the a protein. What we're looking at is every line corresponds with a bond. The default coloring scheme is that carbons are green, which I guess makes sense. Nitrogens are blue, and oxygens are red. If we do some looking around, which I can basically do by just dragging my mouse around, and you might eventually be able to see
some yellow. I think I see some right there. Yeah. So if I zoom in on that. So you can see that atom there is yellow, and that's a sulfur atom, and that's part of a methionine. Right? So now it should be obvious to you looking here that this is really hard to make sense of, right? I mean, it's not like this is obvious. It's also harder if you're using your laptop trackpad, so I do recommend using a mouse with Pymol. And when you're using a mouse, the right mouse button sort of zooms in and zooms out, so I don't want to give anybody's vertigo, but that's what I'm doing now. The left mouse button you can drag and reorient the atom or the molecule. If you have a three-button mouse, the middle button lets you sort of move up and down. And then the scroll button operates something called the slab. And so you can think of the slab being sort of the you know, if your visual plane, like if you're looking at into a really dense collection of atoms, a slab is basically saying, I'm only going to look at atoms between this hand and this hand. And I can make my slab really big, so I'm looking at every atom, in which case I have to compete for, you know, all those atoms overlap one another. If I make my slab too small, I'm not looking at any atoms. And so you can see if I use my mouse button, I can go from having a slab that's really large, where I'm looking at the whole molecule, to where if I scroll down, you can see that parts of it start going away as I adjust my slab and make it smaller and smaller and smaller. So this is about the thinnest slab that I can look at. And you can see as I rotate my molecule through and different atoms come into the slab and go out of the slab, it's pretty impossible to figure out what the heck's going on. So I'm going to make my slab big again. These little crosses, those correspond to those water atoms that we were looking at a few minutes ago. Right? And so you can see, you know, there's a reasonable number of water atoms. But, you know, it's not like there's a ton of them. I have to wonder, I've always wondered about this guy, right? Because it's like, well, that's so far away from the protein. Do you really think that that's a static water molecule that's there enough that it's persistent? And, you know, you could actually go back with a lot of this experimental data. We're not going to talk about this. But you can go back and you can actually reload the electron density and you can compare the agreement between the density and the calculated structure yourself. But I've just never had that kind of time where I could like load it up and see if there's something really there for that water molecule. Pymol has some options here. So with every molecule that you load, it'll show up here in this list of objects. And A stands for actions, and so under A I can go in, and there's an action here to remove waters. And now I'm just looking at all the heavy atoms, right? There's still stuff in here, like if you see these phosphate things, those are from that molecule that's the inhibitor. If I look really close, yeah, there you can see it. So this little green cross, that's the calcium ion. So it hasn't removed all of the heteroatoms, but it has removed all of the waters. There's options here to show things and to hide, so that's what S and H are. And so I can show like a cartoon representation. You can see it's reading in this case it's going to start out by reading in the secondary structure as defined in the PDB. So remember we saw that helix and strand entry in the PDB text file. You know, it's using that to calculate what it thinks the secondary structure should be displayed as. It can also go back and do its calculation on its own based on the hydrogen bonding that it thinks should be there. But by default, it says, okay, this is what the investigator thought the secondary structure is. So this is the secondary structure I'm going to draw. I can also go in here and hide. So if I want to hide the lines that it displays by default, now I'm looking at the perfectly cartoon representation of things. these little options here, this window, is very useful, but just like working on a command line in Unix, ultimately for the most power, you really need to be typing things in. And so PyMol has two places where you can type things in. There's a command line down here in the visualization window, and there's also one up here in the menu sort of window. And you know, typing it in doesn't matter. So for example, if I want to show sticks again, I can go and type show sticks. I can type it in up here, it works like that. If I type it in down here, if I type hide sticks, it'll go away. So it doesn't matter where I type it. If I ever want to sort of look at a history of text that I've typed, I can hit escape. And so here you can go back and that hides the graphics of the molecule, but then it also shows the most recent couple of commands you put in. This will also show it up here in this sort of window that scrolls. I hit escape again to bring back my graphics. Okay? There's all sorts of things I can do. So for example, if I want to show spheres, now it's going to draw them as space-filling spheres. So I can sort of see what approximate space this molecule is taking up. In this case, I usually buy computers with a fairly beefy graphics card. And so you can also go in here and do things like adjust the display quality. And so in this case, if I switch to maximum quality, you can see the smoothness becomes a little bit more pronounced. If I really want something that's publication quality, what I really want to do is go in and type Ray. And again, if you work through the tutorial, the very last sort of section talks about ray tracing. This is the command that's disabled in the Schrodinger version of the code. Okay, and so if you type Ray, you see that now these things look maybe not quite photorealistic, but they look very, very nice. There's shadows that are being projected. But as soon as I click on the button again, you know, it basically gets rid of that calculation, right? Because a ray trace is basically you assume that you have a light source and you're actually calculating how rays of light or rays of photons are coming off of that light source, reflecting off of the material, and coming back to the camera, whatever the camera is, in this case, the screen. And so that takes a little bit more work. Sometimes ray tracing is very fast, but if you have a very complicated image, you could end up with ray tracing that takes, you know, 5-10 minutes to render. So keep that in mind. I mean, you pay a price for making very, very high quality molecular graphics. I think this is a little bit confusing, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to hide the spheres. And instead, what I can do instead, if I don't want to show every atom in a spherical representation, I can use selection strings to show spheres for particular atoms. Right? So here I can go and hit show spheres, and I can use, you know, PyMol has all sorts of selection syntax that you can select specific atoms. And so, you know, in this case I type show spheres element calcium. And so now it's going to show spheres for every calcium ion that it has in the structure. In this case there's only one. There are some other things I can do, like, for example, I can show sticks. And one of the selection keywords is, I think it's just het, which selects the heteroatoms. And so now it's going to use the stick representation to show this inhibitor. And now there's a sphere representation for calcium. And I'm using a cartoon representation for everything else. Okay, how do I know how to do the selection syntax? Well, again, the tutorial walks you through a little bit about that. But if I type here help selection, you can see that up here, it's probably better to read it up here because you can actually scroll. But here it gives you a list of all of the keywords that you can use for selecting atoms and residues in PyMol. Okay, so some of the important ones are like residue names. So for example, if I wanted to show sticks all of the lysine residues. You can see there's quite a few lysines in staphylococcal nuclease. I can color those lysine residues. So suppose I want to color gray. Residue lysine, or anything that's named lysine, and have it be carbon. Right? And so now I've colored all the carbon atoms gray for all of the lysine residues in staphylococcal nuclease. And so this is a way to highlight residues that you might be interested in. Okay, all of the options are up here. There's some really specific ones that are useful. And again, I'm going to leave you guys to the tutorial to sort of walk you through selection codes and how to use them. But it's an extremely powerful program. Another thing that you might occasionally run into is if you're doing a printout for a journal or your lab notebook, you might want to set the background to be white so that you're not wasting a whole lot of black ink. And now if I ray trace that, you can see again, it's getting there. You know, I might highlight my color yellow. Let's see if I can't tweak my slab a little bit. So now you can see this is a fairly close-up view of showing how lysine residues come in and interact with these phosphate groups near the active site of staphylococcal nuclease. And so it's an extremely powerful program. If I want to save this session, so saving the session means basically saving the configuration of Pymol so that when you open it up, it remembers the orientation of the molecule and the way that you've sort of colored and drawn everything. That's pretty easy. You go up here to File and you hit Save Session As. And your session files are generally going to end with PSE, so Pymol session. So if I call that test.pse. And now I can close Pymol entirely. And I have this test.pse file on my desktop. If I double click that, it opens up Pymol. And it basically remembers all of the settings that I did, so I don't have to start from scratch. And so if you spend a whole bunch of time, you know, making an image in Pymol, you want to save the session file. Even if you have a good graphic, like if you make a high-resolution ray-traced PNG file, you still want to save the session because you might need to go back and tweak something later on. Once you do ray-trace it, though, you can save the image file by going in and hit Save Image. And now it'll let you save your image as a PNG file. So if I go here and type test.png, and that should, yep, there it goes. So there it is. I can double click that. And that now comes up in Windows Photo Viewer. If you need crazy amounts of resolution, like maybe you're trying to shoot for a cover image or a cover illustration, you can give your ray a parameter. So it takes parameters as far as number of pixels in X and Y. And so if I give it 2,000, that means the X coordinate is going to be 2,000 pixels when it does the final render. And now you can see that that's, you know, it's, you know, this screen is not 2,000 pixels wide. So it gives me sort of a preview of what that looks like. And now I can save that. So now I can save my image. Before I touch it, I don't want to touch the screen. Otherwise, it all goes away. And that's a real sad day if you spend 5 minutes or 10 minutes rendering. Or worse, if you spend a couple hours. So I'll just call this big.png. And now you can see if I open that, it takes Windows Photo Viewer a little bit longer, but the image is much bigger. And I can actually zoom in, and it's still pretty high resolution. So if you're trying to make a really high quality image, generally you don't need more than 300 dots per inch. So don't kill your advisor and send them, you know, a 200 megabyte file from a PDB rendering. Try to be a little bit conscientious for how big you're going to be making this. But if it works, it works, and you can do that and probably end up with something that's quite good, and certainly good enough for publication using PyMol. Okay, so we haven't covered all the depths of PyMol, but again, that's why I give you guys the tutorial. I think you'll learn better by playing with it yourself too. But any questions about what we've talked about this session? Okay, we're gonna do another maybe five minute break or so. We'll come back and do lab notebooks. I think that'll be a pretty quick session, so we still should end by 5. And we'll pick it up in a few minutes.